process is the first selection, the proposal that will be submitted by August of 1987 will be reviewed by Department of Energy, basically on do you meet the minimum qualifications? And the main thrust of my testimony here today is to say that one of those minimum qualifications will be the state can deliver the land, okay? Then, those that all that meet the minimum qualifications, which I am certain if we're able to get things like this done, Oregon will be able to do, will go into a review by a scientific panel appointed by the National Academy of Sciences. That will be a completely non-political review, in my estimation. That will be a serious effort to come up with a handful of sites that will be the best sites from a scientific point of view. Now, let me say something about that one. We're doing our part of the process
okay.
there.
We're okay so far, because I think we can ring the
by having through. The scientist out here and by being active in the community. Then that group is instructed, at least in the information that I have from DOE, to present back to the Department of Energy, is what it says, okay, an unranked list of a few sites. Now, it might be useful to review what happened in the last such process when Fermilab was selected. Paul Olam, who was on the Governor Attia's task force, could speak to that. That task force, in fact, had as a consultant one of the participants in that previous selection process. You may want to hear from him on that, and also on the question of site selection, because that task force has made a recommendation as to site, and that is the site in the Southern Willamette Valley that we're talking about right now. So I can't tell you how much political clout will mean, okay? Because I can't tell you whether the Republicans or the Democrats will be in power when that final decision is made, because the chances are it will not be made until after 1988.
Look,
thank you. That helped, from my mind, clarify some things. Last question. The chair suggested something less than the total preemption, which is suggested in Senate Bill 389, an expedited process with direct combined process, expedited with going directly to LUPA and an appeal, but not, I assume, not de novo appeal to the Supreme Court in order to, boom, get it done and maybe even put a time certain, say, if you don't do it within 12 calendar months, it's a done deal. You get the outcome. Is that something that might be just as worthwhile in getting over the threshold of the minimum requirements of can we get to the land?
My guess would be no. But I would need to see how the minimum qualifications are actually stated. I expect that Department of Energy is going to want to be assured that this will not be a hang-up, that the land will be available. And I think in terms of the needs for this, the land for the superconducting supercollider and the fact of its very small environmental impact, that it is the sort of thing that does warrant the kind of exemption that this bill asks for. The fact is that either we get the superconducting supercollider, and I think at that point we'd be glad to have it and glad to not have to go through the, or we don't, and if we don't, this bill becomes moot. And so it's not an exemption that then carries on into the future for other kinds of activities.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Further questions? Thank you very much, Dr. Baldwin.
Marcy Schwartz from CH2M Hill.
Hi, let me talk for a few minutes and then I've got a few slides to show.
Okay.
I'm only going to discuss the land use issues directly related to the SSC during my testimony, but if you have questions on other topics,
great,
I'll address them to the extent I can,
great,
if you want me to. My testimony is going to cover these points. The land required by the SSC, the existing land use at the SSC site that's proposed, and the need for the Senate Bill 389. The SSC is proposed by the U.S. Department of Energy as the world's largest proton collider. Its purpose is scientific research. High-energy physicists need it to test theories on the most basic forces that hold together all matter, everything we know. The main features of the SSC that require large amounts of land are the campus where the researchers would actually work. That's offices and labs and those kinds of facilities. The underground interaction halls where proton beams collide and the experiments are actually conducted. And the underground collider ring itself. Okay, let's do the slides. Good. You need the lights too.
Yeah, she'll get them from over there.
Okay.
Okay. All right. This schematic shows the underground interaction hall set within the main collider ring. The collider ring is in blue, and the interaction halls on the two sides opposite each other are in the little white boxes. The campus would be located to the side or even inside the ring at any point along the ring. The campus would accommodate most of the 3,000 workers at the SSC site, and it would be very much like a college campus. This is a picture of the Fermilab SSC in Illinois, and you can see to the side the white campus-like structure that runs beside the ring. For existing needs, future expansion capability, and the buffer, the campus requires about 8,000 acres. I use the word about because USDOE has released only the preliminary criteria. However, the final criteria, which are due out in April, are not expected to differ very much from what we've been dealing with so far. Because the campus would be a permanent land use, all 8,000 of these acres would be owned by USDOE. Now, I've been talking about 8,000 acres, and I'll name some other acreage figures as we go along. These are a little different from ones that you've heard from Senator Yee and others that you may have heard throughout the discussion of this process. The reason for that is that there have been a series of criteria that have been given out, and they've changed a little bit from time to time, and the way the different acreages are lumped together for the different required facilities is different. So if we need to try to figure that out later, we can try to. But basically, for everything but the collider ring itself, a maximum of 8,000 acres is, I think, what DOE is talking about at this time. Similarly, DOE would want to take title to another 4,000 acres around the ring. And this would be the land on which the six interaction halls are located, and you saw those in the previous slide, as well as the location of 26 points of access to the ring, which would be used for maintenance, and an additional amount of acreage for the access roads themselves. Land above the collider tunnel would not have to be owned by USDOE. Easements, the kind that are commonly used for pipelines and other underground utilities, would be sufficient for most of the 52-mile circumference ring. Land above this tunnel could stay in its current ownership and in its current land use. Terms of the easement would prohibit things like drilling into the tunnel or deep excavation and construction of permanent facilities right on top of the tunnel. That would be prohibited. But activities like existing agriculture could continue just as they do today. Additionally, land inside the ring would remain in its existing ownership and in its existing land use. This is a picture of a superconducting supercollider in Geneva, Switzerland. And the red line on there shows the main conductor collider ring. And the reason I'm showing this to you is largely because if the red line weren't on there, I don't think you'd be able to tell where the ring was actually located. Because as you can see, the land use pattern is pretty much the same there as elsewhere, and it doesn't really interrupt existing activities. So taken together then, the SSC would convert about 12,000 acres from current use to scientific research purposes. That's the 8,000 maximum for the campus and its related facilities, and 4,000 for facilities that would be located around the ring. Additional land would be needed for the project, but would not be acquired by USDOE and would require only easements for use. A task force appointed by former Governor Attia recommended a site for the SSC in Oregon, in Linn County, near Lebanon. And this is a picture of the preliminary location of the ring. Details of the exact ring location on the ground and the site of the campus, the interaction halls, and the access roads have yet to be detailed. From the work that we've already done, though, some things are very clear, and that is that nearly all of the land crossed by the ring is designated for farm use. And secondly, that no Oregon city has a single parcel, or even a number of parcels of 8,000 acres within its urban growth boundary that's already designated in its comprehensive plan for a scientific research park. I guess everyone would agree to that. So for these reasons, siting of the project, the collider ring, as well as the campus part of the park, would require an exception to both the statewide planning goals for agriculture and urbanization. And as has been pointed out, the LCDC goals and guidelines include a procedure for taking such an exception. It's been our experience that preparation and adoption of uncontested exception statements typically take a city or a county about 6 months. If landowners or other affected parties object in any way, the procedure can exceed a year. Since the SSC site proposals must be submitted to USDOE in August, indicating that the land can be made available, is readily available, there's not enough time to go through the usual exception procedure. The legislature formally had authority under state land use statutes to make its own determination of consistency with the LCDC goals for projects of statewide significance. But that's no longer the case, and that's why we need SB 389. We need it because the SSC is a project of even greater than statewide interest. It's a scientific facility that will establish world preeminence in high energy physics. It will generate employment and commerce well beyond and outside the county in which it's sited, in the metals industry, supercomputers, and other support services. Its economic impact would be felt throughout the Northwest. It's clearly the type of project over which a statewide governing body should have jurisdiction regarding consistency with land use goals. The proposed location of the collider ring crosses 431 tax lots. I think you can imagine that if you look at the slide. Given this number of properties, sheer probability would suggest that at least one owner would not want to sell his or her property. And a recent Attorney General's opinion indicates that the state does not have the right to condemn land for the SSC project. Although it's always regrettable to acquire land by condemnation, the provision of SB 389 that gives this authority to the state is necessary to demonstrate Oregon's capability to deliver the required land for the SSC project. Okay, I think the lights can go back on. And I think as already has been said, Oregon is behind other northwestern states and California in this siting project. Lights are strong. By our own. By our own firm's assessment, Oregon is about 3 weeks behind on an accelerated schedule that was designed to get the proposal ready to deliver to DOE in August. So I think you can see how critical it is for you to take quick action on this important project. I encourage the passage of Senate Bill 389, including the amendment that's been described by Senator Yee, that would exempt the SSC Scientific Research Park and its appurtenant facilities, as well as the collider ring, from application of the statewide land use law. And since it may also be necessary to condemn property for the research center, the state needs this additional authority as well.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Cairns.
I believe I heard you say that the exceptions process and the even an accelerated decision-making process would be unacceptable in your testimony. Is that correct? Is that, in essence, what you said?
I think I agree.
You heard the question I gave Dr.
Right.
Mosley.
And I agree.
You concur.
Yes.
Thank you.
I think it gives it an entirely different message.
Let me ask, can I ask a couple questions of you?
No.
I guess so.
What,
we've seen a lot about this big circle, this big ring out in farmland, and their farming seems to be going on. What can you tell me about the environmental impact of this facility beyond? Why wouldn't someone want to live on top of it?
In the work that CH2M did talking about different sites and the relative impacts, we really couldn't find any strong negative environmental impacts.
Radiation or anything? I mean, none? What about the creation of radioactive waste?
I'm going to have to apologize that I can't answer that question. I'm not the project manager from CH2M for the project. He's recovering from emergency surgery in California, and he could answer, but I think what I'd say might not be accurate, so I'd rather not. I don't know whether... Okay.
John, why don't you come up?
This accelerator...
Identify yourself for the record.
Okay, John Mosley.
Thank you.
This accelerator, it accelerates beams of particles. The number of particles involved are extremely small, and these particles at high energies collide into the metals in the ring and that sort of thing, and so there's a small amount of radioactivity created there. The radioactivity is not long-lived radioactive waste such as that created in a reactor, and the only radioactive waste that's created is essentially decays away within minutes and hours, because then personnel come right back in to work on the ring immediately after this has happened. So there is no significant creation of radioactive waste.
What about decommissioning?
My understanding is that decommissioning simply would involve either walking away from it or tearing it down, that there's no problem with storing anything that's ultimately left. Beyond the kind of thing that one finds in any normal university laboratory that's using some small amount of radioactive materials. So it's not in the same league as decommissioning a nuclear reactor.
It wouldn't be.
Yeah.
I mean, I would assume that.
Yeah, okay. I think it's in... It's no more complicated than the disposal of the small amounts of radioactive waste that one uses in hospitals for radiotherapy, in research laboratories, in universities.
Okay. Further questions? Thank you very much.
I'm going to temporarily close the hearing on Senate Bill 389. Lila Culley from Economic Development Department still wants to testify, and I hope Eldon Hout wants to testify. But I want to move into work session before we lose the Republican members of our committee. So I'm going to close the hearing on 389 temporarily, to be reopened again hopefully at about 4:30, and open the work session on Senate Bill 11. We have amended Senate Bill 11. We adopted the, I think we've all got a hand and growth bill in front of us, labeled SB 11-5. The reason I didn't move the bill out at our last work session was because of concerns about whether or not it needs to go to Ways and Means. In conversations with the Senate President, his suggestion to me was that we go ahead and move the bill, and if it needs to go to Ways and Means, he can send it there. But that he and I and Senator Thorne would intend to sit down and discuss it tomorrow.
You're working from SB 11-6 LC, date
387? I think it's dash 5, but I don't...
It was incorporated in 6.
Okay.
Yeah, it was incorporated as I...
Oh, then we got dash 6.
Dash 6.
Okay.
Includes the amendments which we adopted on...
Thank you.
Whatever last we...
Okay,
met.
So I think that the proper motion would be to substitute the SB 11-6 amendments for all prior amendments.
So moved, Mr. Chairman.
I think that this contains the whole bill, doesn't
yep.
it? Yep. Senator Karen, including the provisions we adopted conceptually on Friday?
Yes.
Okay.
Those are all incorporated. And as you'll see on lines 2 through 6 on the on LC 407, SB 11-6, it deletes the prior bill, substitutes a substitute bill. You know, this takes the form of a substitute.
Okay, this is a substitute bill, I mean, this amendment. Okay.
Right.
So, Senator Cairns moves the adoption of LC amendments 11, SB 11-6. Senator Cairns, having under discussion, Senator Cairns, why do we insert appropriating money on lines 3 and 4?
In order to address the expenditure limitation for the department for the fees to be collected and submitted to them.
Where does the bill as it's drafted appropriate money?
It provides in
section 4.
Well, in section 4, the department awards grants to municipalities pay 75% of the costs of conducting the program.
All right. That isn't appropriate money to them.
No, it awards the grants. It doesn't appropriate money for the department as such. They are permitted to, but they are going to need, if this becomes law, is an expenditure limitation adjustment for other funds. Really what it comes down to.
That's not appropriation.
No, it's not an appropriation money.
So I don't see an appropriation in the bill.
No.
There's definitely a fiscal. I'm not saying there's not a fiscal impact. I don't see an appropriation.
That is correct.
So it doesn't appropriate money.
That's correct.
So I guess I would suggest that we delete appropriating money.
Fine with me. You won't get any argument out of me on that score, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, so
I would include that as a friendly amendment to my motion.
Senator Cairns moves that we adopt LC SB 11-6 with the deletion in line 3 and 4 on page 1 of the words appropriating money.
That's still declaring an emergency.
It still declares an emergency. Is there any further discussion on the adoption of these amendments? Is there any objection to the adoption of the amendments?
Appropriating money?
Oh, well, no. Actually, Senator Cairns has put it all as one.
Well, I do.
Okay. Fine. Let's call the roll on the amendments. These are Senator Cairns' amendments with the deletion included as a friendly amendment to the amendments.
Senator Brenneman?
No.
Senator Cohen?
Aye.
Senator Hamby?
Aye.
Senator Cairns?
Aye.
Senator Kintai?
No.
Senator Bradbury?
Aye. Motion is adopted. Okay. Senator Cairns?
Move the bill, Mr. Chairman, to the floor with a due pass for recommendation as amended.
Senator Cairns moves SB 11 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any further discussion? Clerk, would you call the roll, please?
Senator Cohen?
Aye.
Senator Hamby?
Aye.
Senator Cairns?
Aye.
Senator Kintai?
No.
Senator Brenneman?
No.
Senator Bradbury?
Aye. Motion is adopted. Senator Cairns, would you carry it, please?
Be granted. Mr. Chairman, just for the record, I wanted to make sure that everybody understood that on page 4 of the amended bill, I believe it's at line 7, there was a question raised vis-a-vis the St. John landfill, and it's our understanding, and just for the record, I want to enter it here, that it's Metro that we're talking about, not the city of Portland, which owns the land. It's run by Metro, so they're the ones that collect it. We're not asking the city to submit something they haven't collected and not collected from Metro, who did collect it. So, just for the record.
Good. Okay, moving on to Senate Bill 337. This bill does go to Ways and Means. It is a fee bill, and there are some amendments that we have. Has everyone received them?
Legislative Council 337-3. They were drafted at the request of Representative Sola, who I don't know if Larry is here. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Larry, why don't you come forward? 337-3 amendments do a couple of things. They raise the elk tag from the proposed $20 to a proposal of $25. They raise the deer tag from the current $6 to $12. And then they also have some provisions relating to the number of non-resident mountain goat tags and the number of non-resident mountain sheep tags. And Representative Sola, particularly on those, well, I want to ask you to explain the non-resident part, but let me just say that the proposals to raise the elk and the deer tag raise a total of $2,489,000 in the wildlife fund. Representative Sola, can you speak to the other portion of your amendment?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm representing Sola, District 26. There's been a lawsuit a few years ago in New Mexico that because a gentleman couldn't receive a mountain sheep tag, he was a non-resident of New Mexico, and he filed a suit, and the court ruled in his favor. Now that same gentleman is in Colorado in court, suing Colorado, that saying that he can't get equal treatment with Colorado for a mountain sheep tag. And so talking to the officials in Colorado, they felt that if they would have had a 10% non-resident provision in their mountain sheep regulations, that he probably wouldn't have filed the suit. So the department asked for a 5% non-resident number, and so they tried to solve the problem. Maybe this guy won't come here and file the suit. We said no less than 5 and no more than 10%. If we go too much over 10%, we're liable to get quite an outcry from our resident mountain sheep hunters. And so, and keep in mind that this, once you receive a mountain sheep tag or a mountain goat tag, but we don't presently hunt mountain goats at this time in the state. Once you receive the mountain sheep tag or a mountain goat tag, that's once in a lifetime. You never have the opportunity to do that again. So people really, you really get a lot of applications, and people, this is something they really want to hunt for. So, and you'll notice in the bill also, in the original bill, that it jumps the resident fee up to $90 and the non-resident up to $900, which adequately indicates the type of desire there are for these tags.
That's in the existing bill?
That's in the existing, yes.
Mm-hmm. Any questions regarding the 337-3 amendments that Representative Sola is proposing? Okay, thank you.
Okay.
Now there are, well, I guess we should deal with these one at a time.
You've got a couple more that seem to be variations on that.
Well, there's 337-1 and 337-2, which are basically similar, but just deal with the fees in a different way. So those are all from Representative Sola. There are other issues that we need to deal with. I know that Senator Hamby has one. Representative Branham had another concern. So,
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Cohen.
Let me just go quickly to the other two of these amendments, just to sort of get a quick fix on what they're doing. I assume that dash one doesn't deal with elks at all and raises 6 to 8 for deer.
That's correct.
And dash two doesn't deal with elk at all and raises six to ten.
That's right.
Okay. That's the clarification that I needed for me, and the rest is all the same.
Right. I would.
You want to just hear people's ideas on where we want to be on these tag things now before we move on to the next one? Do you want me to say which ones I favor? Is that it, or where are we going?
Well, it'd be fine with me if we walk through and dealt with each amendment as it comes up. There will be other amendments. Senator Hamby has some concerns. We can either hear them all first and then deal with them. Why don't we do that?
May I question the...
Senator Hamby.
Representative Sola's lines 7 through 12 amendment, I apologize if I wasn't tracking, if these had been spoken to, what they would do versus what sub 6 does currently in the bill. Sub 6 would certainly limit the sheer number far to a far greater degree than the amendments you brought forward.
That's right. The amendments were to satisfy the problem with the court actions that have been going on in other states. I guess the question is whether you want to limit it to 5% or under, or whether you want to risk the court action, which might open it up to equal application from non-residents as residents.
Okay. May I ask Representative Sola another question while he's on the stand? In glancing over the list of requested increases for the various tags, I noticed that the cougar tag is not touched.